Peter Thomas Fornatale here. Before we get started today, just want to give a special word about our friends, our founding partner, the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. We started these shows just about a year ago, had no idea how things were going to go, and the very first partner slash sponsor we got involved with was the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. That means so much to me. The year's turned out great. It's been terrific. We've exceeded our own expectations in terms of how many people are listening. At the time, we didn't know how it was going to go. Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation believed in us. We believe in them. The TRF is always in need of support. If you like our show, if you like the fact that you don't have to pay for our show, you know, a lot of podcasts giving out gambling information would be behind a paywall at Patreon or something like that. That's not the way we want to roll. We want to give this show to you, the listeners, for free. And how we can do that is through sponsors and partners like the TRF. Take some time, if you will, and make a donation, trfinc.org/players. That's the best way to do it, so we get the credit. trfinc.org/players. You're listening to the In the Money Players Podcast. Hello and welcome to the In the Money Players Podcast. This is show 96. It is Tuesday, December 10th. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornatale, back with you in the Brooklyn Bunker once again with my fancy new sound equipment. Very excited about the Rodecaster Pro replacing the old Behringer that I irreparably damaged, apparently. My bad on that one. But, you know, you lose something, you gain something, and I think we're sounding pretty good in this show so far, and hopefully we're going to stay that way. Things will improve when you're not just hearing my voice droning on, but we bring in today's guest. He is many things: a horse owner, a horse bettor, a successful contest player, a major fan and supporter of horse racing in general. Talking about my friend Marshall Graham. Marshall, how are you today?
Doing well. I'm speaking to you from Tucson, Arizona. I'm here for the Racetrack Industries Program's annual symposium, and so presenting on a panel with Rick Hammerly, Pat Cummings, our buddy JK, about how can we make our game more appealing to horse players, to our core customers. Next Wednesday, hopefully I'll have a receptive audience. A lot of industry people are here, come to this conference annually. Tucson's a great place to come in December already, and it's again a fun place to be.
I gotta get out there one year. I want to go every year, and it's just so hard. My travel schedule April through the Breeders' Cup is so brutal. I'm worried that if I announced a mid-December solo trip out to the desert that I would be met with papers, but I'm hoping to get there one year. JK, it was rumored was going to try to join us. I'm guessing he stayed out late last night or something.
Either that or he wants to get up to one of these early sessions to see Mattress Mack speak. So it's one of the two. I don't think he stayed out that late. We watched the end of the football game and then went our separate ways. So unless he circled back to the bar to get rid of me, I don't think he stayed out late. But no, as far as getting third papers, I do fear that might happen to me when I get home. I am by making this trip and this conference is basically this full week in December, right at the sort of height of all kids' activities, and so I'm actually missing all of my kids' sort of end of the year performances, activities. In fact, tonight there's two of them, and so they're two kids with each with a different end of the year performance, and my wife can't make both, and she agreed to this a month ago, and then it was immediately like, I can't believe that you're never going to Tucson again. So hopefully I'll make it back in good standing.
Oh my goodness. Well, hopefully there can be some FaceTiming going on or you can get some taste of this stuff. I've got my week lined up. We've got the ballet recital. We've got the winter concert. I think I'm going to have everything under control. We'll use that. I was going to start with your recent contest victory, but we'll get to that in a minute. I'll ask a serious question that I think horse players out there will appreciate the answer to. In all seriousness, how do you balance? You have a proper job as a professor. You bet on horses on the regular. You're doing these industry conferences and things. How do you find time to put in the work needed to be a successful horse player while also balancing another career and a family life?
Well, as far as another career goes, I'm a college professor. I teach at Rhodes College, which is a little liberal arts college in Memphis, Tennessee, and I'm evaluated. Basically, half my evaluation is on my teaching, and I've taught the courses I teach. I've taught them a number of times, and I certainly update them every year, but they're not ultimately a lot of work outside the first preparation, grading exams and doing those kind of things. And then half my evaluation is on research. And, you know, my research is on betting markets. So I'm able to take my research interest and apply it to racing. And so this, I'm at an academic conference that's hosted by the University of Arizona. So I'm here on,
you're working
on sort of Rhodes College official business.
Yeah.
And so, you know, whether I'm doing applied research by looking at the racing form or, you know, looking through data sets, looking at betting markets or, you know, studying breeding, that's in part of my job. So maybe I have an unfair advantage in that way. I've tried to get my kids interested in racing. They do enjoy going to the racetrack. Wherever we go, any of our vacations, there tends to be a racetrack involved. Saratoga is their favorite place to be in the summer. Now, part of it is just, you know, we're getting out of the Memphis heat in the summer. And so the idea of, you know, upstate New York, a small town where they can, you know, wander around freely with great weather is a great joy to them. So that's the highlight of their summer. And so sort of working in a lot of activities around racing that they can do. And there's just an understanding that on a Saturday or Sunday, I'm going to be up in my office watching racing. I'm going to make a few trips here and there, racing related. I've got a very understanding wife who sort of accepts that sort of this is what I do. And it's part of our income. I don't really have any other hobbies. I don't play golf. I don't really do much else. So it's sort of everything that I do, all my hobbies are, you know, it's all tied up in racing. All my hobbies, research interests, free time, I tie it up into every aspect of the game that I can be involved in.
Integrating the different aspects of your life seems to be one key there. But before we go on too much further, I think I'm going to be accused of a host fail if I don't point out the irony of somebody connected to racing going to Saratoga for the weather. It's almost as if you haven't heard of Del Mar.
Unfortunately, that I have, you know, the other part of it is a horse player. If I kind of stick to what I know and stick to what I have time to play in, California racing, it does come on at a time where it's hard for me to do anything but focus on my kids.
Makes
right?
Perfect
so
sense.
The sort of, you know, the I'm in the central time zone, and between 4 and 7, you know, when the kids are at home, you know, I like to at least give some attention to them. And so by then, East Coast racing is wrapping up, California's gone. So just timing wise, if I devoted a lot of time to both East Coast racing and California, it just would suck more time. So and to some extent, for me, California doesn't exist. I mean, I don't really know the trainers or the jockeys, and I'll focus on some of the national races there, or the big race days, but I kind of stick to what I think I know. That's the East Coast track. So I certainly, you know, do I have an East Coast bias? It's probably inherent that I focus a lot more and watch a lot more East Coast racing, but it's all about kind of finding what, you know, finding your niche, what you're good at, and I can only focus on a certain number of things at a time. And so, you know, I focus on, you know, Kentucky, New York.
One more personal question before we move on to the nitty-gritty stuff. One of my favorite pieces in the Mike Maloney book, Betting with an Edge, was when he talked about gambling and relationships, and specifically the importance of, when you're really into racing, being honest with your partner or spouse about how important racing is to you, how time consuming of a hobby this can be. At what point in your relationship did your wife realize that horse racing was going to be part of her life too?
Ever since we've met, I've been playing horses. And so it was always sort of part of what I was doing, you know, even before we met. Still, you know, the big center part of my life when we first met to now. I mean, I do remember my wife is Catholic, and we did the we met with the priest
pre-Cana.
A few times, do the meetings before.
Yeah, pre-Cana.
Yeah, so did some of that stuff, and you know, that sort of brought up to the
it
priest
came up.
And brought up in our little it came up. I said, like, ultimately, if I can make a living doing this, you would be okay if I quit my job and did this full time. And so I didn't ever realistically think that was a possibility, but as things have worked out and I've devoted more time to racing, I'm lucky I've had a job where I can, my devotion to racing is actually part of my research and even my teaching. So I've been able to keep my job, but part of it is being honest and open. The reality is, if she, I've told her some of the numbers and, the days, the big bets or how much we've lost and how much we've won. And it's just, she ultimately rather not hear. Right. And so, I tend not to be one, I enjoy making a big score and, I get frustrated by losing, but I tend to, I try not to let that affect, not to affect my relationship with my wife and kids. I tend not to, celebrate with them when I score, have a big score, or get frustrated if I have a, we don't go out to eat if I have a big score. We don't, have leftovers if I do poorly. So it just I try not to let it affect things because it's all a daily grind. I know that when I have a big score, I know that I'm certain to give some of that money back. And so I try. It's very hard because I tend to be a loss averter. I try not to, I try not to get too up and down based upon, success or not having success on a day by day or week by week or month by month basis.
I think that's great advice. There's so much good stuff in there in terms of the relationship part, the honesty. I love what you said about, she might not want to hear, but it's important that you're willing to be honest about it. I feel like all the problems I've heard about with horse players and relationships come when the party involved is deciding to do things on the sly or is worried about it. Having that willingness to be open, I think, goes a long way. And I think keeping that equanimity, win or lose, is the way to have a normal life and not put your loved ones through the roller coaster of managing one's emotions that is playing this game. Does that sound about right?
Yeah. And the other thing, the privilege I have of, being a college professor, I feel like I'm well compensated. And so just the sort of disconnect between what is my betting bankroll and, what is the money I need to support my family. And my wife works as well. So we have, that there's this nice separation between what I'm doing at the racetrack and, or what I'm doing in my horse ownership and what, we're doing in terms of, the supporting ourselves. And I think I think people get in trouble when, the gambling becomes a problem in terms of affecting, their ability to pay the bills. And so that just not getting myself in that position. And, again, part of that is, part of it is the privilege of having a good, well-paying job and a good, stable job.
Keeping that separate bankroll, even at a very low level, for a player, I think it's so important just mentally to keep that separation for all the reasons you're saying. When do you make the decision with your gambling bankroll to take some of that money out of the gambling money and put it into the life money to pay yourself, as it were, as opposed to just keeping your gambling capital going up and up? What goes into that decision?
I don't have a hard and set rule because I've sort of let my stuff blend pretty well. I don't keep separate accounts except for sort of what I guess I have in each of my ADWs. But so I don't have a good, I don't have a sort of a rule along the lines of that. I do try to think of my bankroll as my bankroll. And that's very hard to do because you play in some of these contests and, you go all in and it's real money that you're losing. And I do know that, the literature on loss aversion is there's an equivalence between losing $1 and winning $2, right? And I think that's something that I know defines me, is that a slight winning day or a big winning day is, it's often, you know, I get the same joy of a big winning day as I do as the frustration that comes from a slight losing day. So I know that that's in my nature. And so playing some of these contests where, you know that your outcome is likely to be losing all your bankroll is hard mentally, right? I remember thinking about it as I flew out to the Breeders' Cup and sort of being melancholy about the fact is that, I could struggle out here in California, not hit my races and, you know, sort of have a five-figure disaster. And understanding I have the bankroll for that, the willingness to absorb that, I guess it was good, right? Is I could absorb, but I still can't help think about, like, that's real money. And that's the hardest thing for me to separate out. I know that there are horse players who are exceptional at that. They're willing to make a bet. They're willing to lose. And I still struggle with that. I think about that all the time.
Do you keep a separate bankroll just for contests, or are you reaching into your pocket when it comes time to write the check for an entry fee and a bankroll for a live bank event?
I have a set of contests that I plan to play over the course of the year. And so if you want to say that's a separate bankroll for that, then I guess that would be the case. The one thing I've done is every single bet I've ever made, I have recorded. So, you go back to graduate school, right? Or go back to when ADW's first open. I keep good records of that. So I have an idea of where I am at any given point of time. I could pull up graphs that sort of represent 20 years worth of betting data. And it's extremely, probably it's over the top, but I kind of like to know where I stand. And so and I treat now these contests as different opportunities for, making a really nice score outside. I'm not a guy who plays a lot of multi-race wagers to make a big score. I'm much more of a win better. I mean, I would say that 70% of my plays are win bets. So I don't hit big tries. I don't hit the pick six. But and so these contests offer real opportunities for added money, sports, added money opportunities when you tend to be a grinded out win exacta player.
I guess where I was going with that was I wondered if you had one bank account with the money in it that was sort of allocated, if you had the liquidity to allocate the money that you were willing to spend in contests for a year, if the potential $20,000 loss at the Breeders' Cup wouldn't hurt as much as if it was completely separate from everything else and you knew that your gains for your contest were going to go into the same place. I was just wondering if it might make you able to make that mental leap that I do feel like you need to do to play contests at your absolute best, where you're treating that money just like chips and chips in a tournament, as opposed to thinking of them as dollars. I just got to imagine it's hard sometimes to commit to the type of plays you need to make when you're thinking about those dollars in a live bankroll contest as dollars on some emotional level.
No, there's no doubt. And that became an entry line in my personal betting spreadsheet. Right, it's a negative $20,000 for Breeders' Cup betting challenge, right?
Yeah, that doesn't seem fair. It doesn't seem fair to it's different to me.
No, I know, but ultimately, I sort of know the bottom line of where I am over a 20-year time frame, and so it's not a separate bank account. It's kind of I know that sort of what I have and what I've devoted to the sport over time, and so what I'm willing to sort of lose for these. Ultimately for these contests that I play. And, initially, I would keep records every day. And now I've decided to go back and total up every month because when I was doing it every day, I'd have the tendency to want to have winning days, which is just deadly, right?
That's a great point.
And so,
explain that more. I agree completely, but explain that more for the listeners.
Well, I mean, I would, I wouldn't like to finish a day down. And so if I was, down, a couple hundred bucks, I would keep playing. And
Chase.
If I got ahead, I would play tentatively. Mm-hmm. So it works in both directions, right? You get ahead early and you have a tendency to sit and not bet as much as you should. And if you get down, you tend to chase. And chasing is a very bad habit. And, most good players, I don't believe chase, right? They make their bets. They make decisions based upon where they see opportunities. that's what I strive to do. But it's, for me, it's a lot easier said than done, right? And I do think the one great thing about these sort of Breeders' Cup, betting contest bet being made public, is it does enforce some discipline, right? The idea that someone is going to potentially look at my bets and look at, oh my God, what is this guy doing, right? And so, you know, it does make me think, well, how do I want the public to perceive me versus how I actually am? Because look, there are days where I'll quit cap. I like to play the horses, and I've tried to be much better about when I have a real opinion betting heavily, and when I don't have an opinion betting $2 to $4 on a horse because I want the action. It's hard for me. When I spend my few weeks up at Saratoga, I don't like passing races. And so it's easy to get yourself in trouble. And so I'll bet $2, $5, $10, something for the action. And then on a race that I really like, I'll unload. And so, sort of back to the record keeping, I'll update my records every month, right? And focus on having winning months as opposed to on, you know, having winning days. Because, you know, again, chasing your losses is deadly. And this is a trap I found myself falling into.
It makes sense, and I feel like it has great business applications as well. When you're chasing just doing well in the next period of time, that can very often be at the expense of what you're trying to do long term. And I think you're exactly right. Those two impulses you might have if you're worried about having a winning day, it's going to make you make the wrong decision in both of them, right? If you're doing well, that's when you're supposed to be betting more. Maybe you're particularly in tune with the track or a bias. And the exact opposite too, when you're in a situation where you're not doing well, you shouldn't be betting more and chasing and trying to get out. You should be betting less and accepting the fact that maybe you're not in tune. I definitely believe that there's something to the idea of momentum or the hot hand theory when it comes to making wagers. I don't think it's as random as rolling dice the way that some people might believe. What do you think about that? Is there something to the idea of the hot hand when it comes to playing the horses?
So that you would have these moments of clarity when you look at a card and everything seems to come together. I tend to not think that's true. Maybe you get into a groove to where you're doing all the work and you have a track really in tune. You really understand what's going on, and so that results in, you know, strong handicapping for that track. So I guess I get that part of it. But as long as I think your focus is on, am I making the right, is my decision making good? Are my bets constructed well? I think that will lead to success versus, you know, getting on sort of this mythical hot streak. If the hot streak is a result of hard work and a consistent and strong approach to the races and seeing a good, you know, good insight into what's going on at the races, then I guess I would agree with you. But if it's sort of just getting on a roll and lining a few things up, I wouldn't say that. I think it's all about, you know, putting in the work. If you put in the work, that can put you on the road to success. I know there are days where I haven't put in the work and I get a little run and do well. And there are others where I do put in the work and do poorly. And I still know that ultimately, if I've made, in my mind, good decisions, that the outcomes will be good in the long run. Because ultimately, there's so much chance involved in any particular race. There's not one outcome, right? I think that we can easily fall victim to whatever the outcome of a race is and then backwards engineer the way our bets should have been. And I'm more likely to think, have I made good handicapping decisions? Have I structured my bets well, sort of regardless of the outcome? The outcome may change, you know, what I think of the horses, but not overall the way I've structured my tickets.
It's very easy to get fooled by randomness. I think that's right. And I think you trying to look at it by evaluating the decisions instead of the outcomes is unquestionably the right way to do it. Let's move on to your success this past weekend. You won this Naira Bets contest. They did something a little bit different. They've done this a couple of times now, seeding the prize pool. Why did you decide to play in this one in the first place?
I had sort of forgotten about it. I was talking to Jonathan pre our trip to Tucson, and he reminded me about the Naira Betts contest to emphasize that it was seeded, sort of a must play. I almost forgot about it. I got a late reminder, and it's like, I've got to register for this. Initially I was thinking about not playing. So we have critical value. Clay Sanders and I bred critical value. Actually, she's out of the first horse that ever won a race for us together in partnership. We had this mare named See the Forest that was a nickel claimer, and we bred critical value, and critical value was in the Demoiselle. And I was very optimistic about our chances in the Demoiselle. I thought we were going to get a very good price, and I was expecting something upwards of 10-1, and I thought she was going to be the foundation for my betting for the day. And in the contest, I'm not allowed to bet for or against my own horse. I have to skip the Demoiselle. And I thought maybe I shouldn't play, because if my focus of my day is going to be the Demoiselle, and I want to really bet that race, and got the big pick six carryover. But ultimately, I just decided there was too much of an opportunity with the added money. And it turns out, if you look at the numbers, there were 118 participants based upon the $250 bankroll and the typical bankroll multiplier that you use. Typically, contest players turn over about 1.7 times their bankroll in these contests. And so that number of 118 players, $250 bankroll, and then times 1.7 equates to about $50,000 in handle generated from the contest. Well, they seeded the pool with $10,000 in additional money. And that basically makes up for the takeout, right? 10,000 is 20% of 50,000, which is probably your blended takeout for what people were playing at Naira. So it really is like a no takeout contest,
yep.
Right? Not only are they returning all the prize money, but they're seeding it with money that they would have earned from takeout.
Yep.
So in that way, it was a wonderful opportunity. So regardless of the fact that I couldn't bet the Demoiselle, which is ultimately good because my horse ran fourth, and the horse that I would jump to when I saw that critical value was bet was Alondra, and she ran up the track. And so that allowed me to, survive in advance in a race where I lost, considerable amount of personal money, and it knocked me out of the pick six. Ultimately, critical value was 4-1, and it shows that, my own perception of my horse and how it's going to get bet, it was totally different from the public.
I love the objectivity you're showing. A lot of people will win a contest and they'll want to come on and talk about how smart they were. And fair enough. One of the great things about racing is when we do well, we get to feel smart for a minute. But you're basically coming on here and admitting that if you were allowed to do what you would have done, had you been allowed to play the Demoiselle, we wouldn't be talking right now.
No, not at all. Well, knocking out of the pick six. And so that was frustrating. And our filly, our homebred, just got beaten for a second the whole way and finished fourth, so
she
just lost on the black pipe.
It's frustrating.
But she was 4-1, and it's an interesting, the sort of whole story around her is probably why I had in my mind she'd be 10-15-1, is that she's a filly that basically everywhere we've had her has thought very little of her. So when she was born, she had a handful of issues. She nearly died on us. The farm where she was raised, every time I went and saw her, they would talk about how poorly conformed she was or how she'd always be wearing some sort of bandage. And so I was told that we were told at least once to think about giving her away. We sent her to break and do her early training, and she didn't distinguish herself. So, normally we send, most of our horses to Brad Cox. We didn't think the horse would fit with Brad because ultimately we thought, we have a homebred, a New York bred. We want to make sure she breaks her maiden somewhere because you want to protect your mare, right? You want your mare to have thrown winners.
Yeah.
And I've gone as far with a previous homebred horse as breaking a maiden by winning a maiden $4,000 claimer on the synthetic at Golden Gate. So we sent to Jeremiah Englehart. Now, Jeremiah does a fantastic job with babies. But we sent to Jeremiah because Jeremiah also goes to Finger Lakes and has a big string at Finger Lakes. And so we thought, maybe she can break her maiden at the bottom at Finger Lakes in the long run. And so the first thing when I saw Jeremiah and I saw the horse gallop, and I said, look, you know, we don't expect anything from her. We we're ready for her to van over to Finger Lakes. So again, you don't have to worry about us. We have very low expectations. No need to sort of pump sunshine to us. And so we were floored when he's like, you know, she's doing well. And then so she ran at Saratoga, ran second, and then broke her maiden, and then ran a real good, ran really well in the maiden mitt, ran a good number. And so, so you put all that from a handicapping perspective, right? Numbers wise, the trip she had in the maiden mitt, the ability to rate and pass horses, probably 4-1 was realistic. But in my mind, she's always been this, smaller filly, we bred the Bodemeister at the height of Bodemeister. So, not the best breeding. The mare's was a nickel claimer for us. She's not the best mover. So that's what I saw, right? So I saw 10-1. The public was more realistic based upon her chances at 4-1. So I thought it was going to be a great betting opportunity. Probably a longer story than you want to hear.
No, it's fascinating. And I wanted to ask about horse ownership, and it's great for the listeners to hear what goes into some of this stuff. We talk about these things more over on the In the Ring show sometimes, but I feel like it helps listeners and horse players tremendously to think like trainers and owners and try to understand what the goals are. So it's a tangent well worth going on, and I appreciate it very much. But let's get back to this contest and talk us through your hits and how you eventually got the spoils.
Well, I knew that I wanted to get to the Cigar Mile, and I felt very confident in Maximum Security. Felt it would be Maximum Security over Spun the Run. I thought that the Exactor was pretty straightforward. I felt Maximum Security was just better horse, even with the sort of late improvement by Spun the Run. I felt very confident that Service is bringing a loaded horse. And so I was hoping to get to that Exacta. If I didn't have a big enough bankroll where that Exacta was going to put me in position to win, I was going to bet the straight try of Maximum Security, Spun the Run, and Looking at Bikinis. Looking at Bikinis has had a number of bad trips bad start in the Travers, bad trip the race before on a dead rail. But ran really well previously at Keeneland. I thought cutting back this one turn mile, this horse is going to get somewhat overlooked. Now, it turned out to be third favorite, so I was taking the favorite, second favorite, third favorite, just pressing a try. So it was really going to depend on what position I would be in. And I had the bet. So the tournament requires five $50 bets. And so I was just basically going to meet my minimums until we got to the Cigar Mile. I didn't have really any opinions on the undercard outside the Demoiselle. Was going to try to manufacture some. It was pretty busy. Part of the reason why I almost didn't play was, the races started at 10:30 in the morning in Memphis. I'm not sure what their logic was, moving the cards back. I didn't really sort of research the 11:30 Eastern starting time, but my wife and daughter were running the Memphis Half Marathon. I had to drive one of my kids around, and our house actually gets blocked in by the marathon. So I just had a lot of things going on that morning. And so made a bet in the first two races, and then was going to be basically out of action for the next four. And so in the first race, the Chad was taking all the money, was 4-5 cost basis. And I thought that, here's a good way to punt. They wouldn't let you bet show, but I'll take, $2.30 to place. But in looking at the race a little bit more, I started really liking the Mark Hennig Homebred for Cortland Farms King Meister. Mm-hmm. It was bet previously and hit the gate, getting out. And I thought this horse, a chance to show a little speed and be a bit of a price. So if I could, just maybe a straight Exacta, play my $50 there and maybe get some sort of bankroll to work with. So I hit $50 Exacta. I got up to $865. Basically from that point forward, I gave back $150. I made three bets that all missed. I really liked a toner horse in race five. I think that was one of the maiden races, and that horse didn't run particularly well. And so, you know, I ended up with $715 into the cigar bow. And so I just, you know, I bet my Exacta. The Exacta was paid, was paying, you know, was always jumping between, you know, $12 and $18. It ended up coming down and paying $14.40, which I thought was, you know, 6-to-1 for maximum security over fund the run. I thought it was a very reasonable price.
Yeah.
I mean, hell, even maximum security at 65, I thought ultimately was a pretty good price. So, you know, so I hit the Exacta and never really had to sweat it. I played another ticket that, where I had $177 on it. And that one I played maximum security over looking at bikinis, and looking at bikinis, it was in third place the whole time. And so, so I didn't really have to sweat it, and it came in, and it was an interesting contest because the scores were pretty low. And so I was somewhat surprised that, no one behind me, I was maybe in eighth place. And so if someone ahead of me had a bigger Exacta, I would have lost, but, I was able to jump all the way to the lead. And, it's kind of an interesting decision. If I hadn't done anything, I think I would have still finished eighth and gotten, maybe $1,500.
There's lessons to be learned from this story. I think part of the reason the leaderboard didn't jump so much is the fact that it was this heavy chalk scenario, because from having talked to so many contest players over the years, there are a precious few who are interested really in dialing down on a favorite over a second favorite. Now for you, and this is a lesson I learned a long time ago. I can remember talking to Andy Serling back in the days when we both worked on the C-Rose show up in Saratoga, and him saying, sometimes the best way to be a wise guy is to know when not to be a wise guy. And I feel like this is a pretty prime example of that. When you look at the return on this Exacta between the two horses that just, really, if you're just looking at buyer speed figures, laid over this field on paper. And I guess maybe there's folks assuming they were going to hook up and one was going to crack and be nowhere. But it actually is kind of surprising to me the Exacta paid what it did, hindsight being 2020. But for you, was there a breaking point where that Exacta would have been low enough that you wouldn't have played it, other than having to do with where you were in the contest? In other words, as long as you could play that Exacta and get to the amount that you thought would win, say, what would that number be? Probably around what it was, right? About 4,900, 5,000. If that had gone lower, would there have been a point where you said, I just can't accept this, even if it might get me to top three in the contest?
It wouldn't have gone lower than $10, right? So I was going to play it no matter what because of the value added, right? I felt like I didn't necessarily think I was going to win when I hit it, right? And so I felt like I'd have a great shot to land the top three. Even if it paid less than I would have hoped, you know, I was going to get money added, right? There was value added to it because of the prize pool. So I was going to pick up, you know, another $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 at least, right? I ended up picking about $14,000. So, you know, I was going to play it pretty much no matter what. And I say that there's a number, it wouldn't sink below based upon what the odds for these two horses were. Right. But given I had $715 to work with, you know, I was watching those numbers. I was hoping I was going to get back $5,000, but in my mind, regardless, I was going to play it. I was going to finish in the top three if it hit. And that was my strategy. And it was, you know, it's sort of, if I was going to beat either of those horses, I was going to try to beat Spun the Run. But, you know, I tried to beat Spun the Run in the Breeders' Cup, and it came back to bite me, even though if there's anyone, you know, I own 90% of the horses in Guerrero's barn. And, you know, he's been high on Spun the Run forever. You and I chatted with him at the Breeders' Cup, and he was extremely confident in Spun the Run's chances at the Breeders' Cup. And I thought, you know, he was going to the well one too many times. You know, here a horse is making its fifth start since September. I was like, this horse, I'm going to be woefully depressed if I try to beat him, you know, try to knock him out of this Exacta. and he shows up again. It's just that horse is just an old school throwback horse. who shows up every time. I knew that they were going to, you know, I knew that they were going to go. I knew that they were going to, you know, try to push maximum security, but the track did carry speed all day. And I wasn't totally aware of that because I hadn't been, hadn't been handicapping all the races, really showed up for the second part of the card. But the track was carrying speed, and I felt that that helped both of them, and I just didn't see anyone else. You know, given that Closer's having a tough time, and given even the field, I didn't think anyone could go with either of them, and I didn't think anyone would come closing, so I felt pretty good about that.
Is that a bet you ever would have made in real life, or is it entirely down to the fact of the added money in the contest pool?
Oh, sure. I would have, at the price of $14.40, I would have made that bet. And I did, you know, I did make the try. Even I didn't play the try in the contest, but I did bet that try. And then I put looking at bikinis in between them. I made that on my own on the side. If I'd realized maximum security was going to drift up to 6-5, I probably would have bet him 2 to win. He was just, he projected out to 6-5 according to the doubles, but he was 3-5 so much of the betting. Then he must have taken that late click jump up to 6-5 because I didn't catch that part of it, so I didn't ultimately bet him the win.
Let's talk about imputed odds for a minute, because it's something that you've done a great job with posting on Twitter for big races, and so important in this world where the win odds can change so dramatically late. What do you feel are the benefits of making the calculations of the imputed odds? And if you can give us this might be going down a rabbit hole, but if you can give us an idea of how that math is done.
I just take the daily doubles, and I have a spreadsheet that I've put together that based upon the daily doubles, you could use the will pay. Those work fine. But I take the daily doubles, and the daily doubles for $2. If you take 2 divided by the double, and then that gives you, you know, a number and like a, almost like a percentage, right? And you add it up across the whole matrix. That sums to about 1.2. And so you divide back through to normalize it to get to 1. And then if you sum across all the horses in the next leg, you get a probability of that horse winning based upon the double, which you can then turn into the odds. I don't think I did a great job.
No, that wasn't bad at all. That wasn't bad at all.
That's effectively, it's effectively what I do. And I do that for any race I bet, because I want to have a good sense of where the money's going to go. Because as we've learned now, even at major tracks, there's a lot of late money movement. It's not perfect. I mean, there's certainly situations where horses will take a lot more money than the double would have projected or a lot less. But in this race, it turned out to be, I don't have the exact numbers, I didn't record them, but maximum security was 6-5 and spun the run was, you know, right at 5-2. And that's about what they ended up. And they weren't that way in the early betting. They were both bet more earlier than they ended up being bet. I mean, I do feel like for a lot of this betting, maximum security was 1-2, 3-5, 4-5. And so I use that and make my bets and decisions based upon those imputed doubles. And even at smaller tracks, it tends to be very useful. So even in smaller double pools, obviously the bigger double pools, like the double pools of Naira or Churchill, it's much more accurate. And I often wonder why the tracks themselves don't use that information as well. They present the double will pays. But that full double matrix can be used to give people projected odds. And
great
why
idea.
Not post that up? It's information. The other thing I think is interesting, and this is I bring this up total tangent, is it spun the run was actually paying less in the Empire 6 Force Out than maximum security.
Yep.
So I thought that was strange, surprising. So I don't know whether, you know, some people had some big tickets with spun the run. I don't usually I find that, you know, that horses like that tend to run well, and those pick six bettors often collectively tend to be pretty good. That made me a little bit nervous that spun the run might win. And but obviously that if spun the run won, I'd be ecstatic for Carlos, and that would be my, I'd lose the contest, but it'd be great for the Guerreros and for the horse, and I'd be happy.
Well, that's great when you can use your racing fandom to help salve some of the wounds of being a racing bettor. I want to stay on this for a minute. In terms of looking at the imputed odds, over time, which type of pools have you found to be more accurate? Is the double a better barometer than the pick three, than the pick six? Is it a question of the size of the pool? The more money that's in it makes it more predictive. Does sometimes having a pick five or a pick six where so many tickets can get knocked out, does that make them inaccurate even though they might have a lot of money in them? Generally speaking, what makes one of those will pays more useful in determining the win odds?
Well, the win pool is the most predictive, and then the double pool is, you know, the more predictive than the pick three pool. And in general, it works that way. In part, the double is better because we see the whole matrix, right? With the pick three, pick four, pick five, pick six, we're only getting that, that potential payout with the winner. So you do have strange things that happen. And I do think it's just looking at these pick five and pick six payouts, it is always interesting to me is when they sort of go in opposite directions. I remember closing day at Saratoga this year, the pick six had, you know, the big carryover, you know, wasn't a positive expectations play, but it was a very low effective takeout. And the pick five, as far as the value was offering, turned out to be much better. And so we do have, you know, funny things that can arise in these multi-race wagers because, you know, the if tickets get eliminated, you know, sometimes, you know, we don't know the exact weight that people put on the particular horses in a race. And we do get some strange results that happen. But usually the double's the best. It's got a big pool. It's one race away from the race that we're looking at. And you get to work with the entire double matrix.
That makes sense. All right. Breaking news. Looks like in 2020, I'm going to be making regular contributions for Jim Mulvihill over at the Briss Betting Guide, looking to do some more sort of personal writing pieces like I've done for them in the past, but also doing some more hardcore handicapping and betting stuff. I think we need to write an article about this imputed odds stuff. You don't have to do any of the work. We'll just like take this interview and then I can ask you a few questions and turn it into something. And would you be willing potentially to share, and feel free if the answer is no, you've already led the horse to water. They can bend down and drink on their own. But would you be willing to share a spreadsheet that allowed some of the players at home to do this at some point? What do you think of either of those ideas?
Sure. Absolutely. And look, people have emailed me and asked for the spreadsheet. And I'll send it to them. There's nothing brilliantly insightful about the spreadsheet. It's just, you know, it's something I wish ADWs would present, right? Just, you know, show what the imputed odds are. I mean, it's not just, you can use it with the exacta pool as well. Right. Not just the double pool. The exact, of course, tends to co-move with the wind pool. But, you know, like part of my interest here in racing as an economist is I love watching markets. And there's a market with incomplete information where the public is establishing the price. Some people who are very well informed. Some people are picking numbers or silks or horse colors. Some people who are insiders. Right. And so you have a lot of different people who are participating in this market. And it always has amazed me in how accurate the public is collectively. Right. Those odds are a strong representation of a horse's probability over time. So whereas in this particular race, right, if you ran this race 100 times, maybe Maximum Security wins, you know, 70% of the time, even though the public sort of projection is, you know, somewhere around 40%. But if you take all 6 to 5 shots, right, they tend to win at the sort of rate that those odds would project, right? So it's really, fascinating to see, right, the idea that we could have this market that's so efficient and yet inefficient in ways as well.
It's amazing, and it's so cool to think about. And I love that idea. If you had one piece of data, if you were retrofitting and you had one piece of data to look at to predict a winner, and you were trying to evaluate them in terms of where the signal was, if you could, you obviously can't have the closing win price, but if you could, that would be just an incredible piece of information that would help you, whether you're building a computer model or just trying to think about racing in terms of what wins races. And the fact is, there are these tools out there that can give you a pretty good handle on what that number is going to be that a lot of people aren't paying attention to. That, folks, is how you can get an edge. And I'm very glad for all the insights you provided on it. This leads to a good question, hopefully, about computer players in general. Obviously, we don't know the exact numbers, but we know that more and more of the parimutuel pool is being generated by the so-called CRW, computer robotic wagering players. How does the effect of the computer players change your day-to-day horse player life, Marshall? What are some of the tools and tactics you can use to continue to compete and try to go toe-to-toe in this ever-increasingly difficult marketplace?
Well, first is that when I look at a race, or when I, you know, when I look at a race and put in all the effort I should, is when I think about betting the horse or think about keying the horse, I think about reasons why I would like that, why I like this horse, and I think it offers value relative to what everyone else is seeing. So what am I seeing that makes me think this horse is more likely to win than what the public sees, right? So ultimately, whether it's computers or it's the general public, you know, it's part of it is computers have made the market more efficient. Part of it is it's horse players are smarter, right? And horse players have more tools than they've ever had. And horse players are more educated about races. A lot of the numbers and, you know, numbers players and casual players are now go to the casinos, right? And play the lottery or play slots. And so, you know, I try to find out, why do I like this horse? Why do I think this horse offers particular value? If I can't come up with any good reason, then I'm better off just betting $2 and betting off passing the race. So what makes this horse have a unique opportunity that I don't, that the public is overlooking? And the second thing I try to do is I try to really focus on how I structure my bets. And I do still, you know, I play a lot of, I do bet a lot to win. And honestly, I bet winning in place. I can't, because of the sort of psychic problems I have with being a loss averter, I do bet win place. I can't help it, even though I know that it's not a lot. Betting the place is probably not, it probably doesn't offer the returns it should, but I bet win place at 70% of my betting. Pick one for me is hard enough. The idea of doing a double or an exacta or a try, unless I have real opinions on what is going on a race based upon its flow, or whether I'm trying to key a horse. So one thing I like to do now is I like to structure trifectas and superfectas, focusing on horses underneath in a race or focusing on the way I think the race is going to flow. And so, you know, I do wish that more we'd be devoted to developing tools that would allow horse players to compete on the same footing as CRWs. What CRWs are able to do is they're able to bet tries and supers efficiently. Right, they're able to, you know, hammer out dime tickets or 50-cent tries based upon assessed probabilities of a horse finishing first, second, or third. And so, you know, what I try to do is I try to take some of the public's information and then use some of, you know, my handicapping skills and try to make tickets keying horse certain positions in the try or super and approach it differently than trying to, you know, box up a bunch of horses or focus on the horses on top. So often I'm focusing on horses underneath. Right. If my horse wins, I may have a saver bet, but that may not be the best outcome.
You talked about finding ways that you're seeing a race differently than what the public or the computers are going to see. What type of information is going to give you the kind of edge you need to really fire in those situations? What's an example of something you're seeing that the public isn't seeing?
It'd be familiarity with a horse, where they talk about trips, and trips are important, but if trips are if the trip is not, if you have a bad trip that's not subtle, everyone's going to pick up on it and overreact to it. So I'm looking for subtle bad trips, being in the wrong part of the track, being against the flow of a race, or being in the wrong, being in the wrong race, you know, or, you know, maybe even the trainer's not ultimately their focus, right? So, you know, you hope to get in a position today where you're getting a horse who's been against a handful of times, and maybe now at the proper distance, has a proper pace scenario to run into. And look, I think that's something that a lot of the experts are picking up on as well, but maybe not to make it fully efficient.
Yeah, and I wouldn't think the computers would be particularly good at what you're describing. So I think the sharper players are going to be in tune with what you're talking about. But if we're living in a world where 40% of the money is coming generated straight off the paper, when you can find times that what's on the paper is misleading for the reasons you just cited, I could see maybe getting into some situations where there's some meat on the bone. And then if you bet that opinion efficiently, all of a sudden, maybe you have something.
Well, and there's another aspect to that. We have to remember what computers are doing. I think people think that there's incredible magic going on. You know, they're building a data set based upon their set of races and their past performances. And so if you're looking at a race that has 12 horses that have all run a significant number of times going the same distance, right, at the same class level, you know, that race is going to be very efficiently bet because the computers are going to be able to analyze that. They have a lot of data to work with. But if you're looking at, races with a handful of shippers, a lot of horses switching surfaces, and a lot of first-time starters, that's going to be hard for a model to properly evaluate. And so, those races, if you have any insight in them, they're real opportunity. What I'm emphasizing with that, a 12-horse race full of horses that have run before at the same level, the same condition, is at that point you move into a larger sample size, which again, the computers are going to have an advantage processing that data. So, what we hope to do, and you hope in beating computers is to sort of process smaller sample size, right? Smaller sample size. I talk to my students when I teach my betting course about small sample size decision making, right? Coming up really with, you're making decisions when, what might be happening is truly noise or randomness, or there might be some nugget there. So, if you can pick up subtle things like a trainer getting hot before the public does, you can really take advantage of that, right? A couple of trainer's horses outrun their odds, right? Then maybe that's something to jump upon before the public identifies it. Once the public identifies it, it's baked into the price.
Yep, that's great. One thing I think computers are doing in those maiden races, this is down the rabbit hole stuff, but I think there are some of them, and we've talked to Tony Joe about this a little bit, where they're analyzing the market itself and looking for, I think they have a way of sort of intuiting the so-called inside information through looking at the way the money is coming in. Now, there are others out there, Garrett Skiball, I'll name as somebody, who refers to maiden races as, almost like these benefits for insiders and doesn't think that rank and file horse players should play them because there's information that they don't have. I think you can get a lot of that information by learning how to read the tote board in maiden races yourself. What do you think about this issue in general, and what is your approach as a player to maiden races? Do you feel like you need some inside scoop to be able to participate in them, or do you feel like they're races where you can get an edge as an informed outsider?
So I guess I agree with both of you, is that certainly the tote board reveals a lot of information. I'm certain that their money flows really represent what's going on there. And, definitely we see many examples in Saratoga of a steam horse and you read, even in Andy Byer's original book, he talks about people who are like, I guess he called them chartists.
Yeah, sure.
So people Doc. Who watch the tote board, yeah, and made their betting decisions based on that. In some ways, there's no doubt that's a big part of computer modeling. But for me, I guess I more agree with Garrett, is that insiders are going to have information I'm not going to have. I'll play a maiden race if I can be one of those insiders or have real good information coming to me, or if it's part of a larger pick sequence where I just hope to stay alive. But I feel like it's just that too much of a history of trying to bet a steam horse, following the odds down and then just getting crushed. So those tend to be, and that's a big part of Saratoga, right? Is seeing these maidens run. I very much enjoy those races, but those tend to be my $2 races. Those tend to be watch along, hope to see a star tomorrow and then bet them back later on.
You said already that you're not playing as many horizontals as you are in the wind pool, but when you are looking at a maiden race in a horizontal sequence, I'm going to take a wild guess that your tendency is to be much more inclusive in those spots. Is that right?
Yeah, and I sort of hate doing it. But, I mean, the Empire 6 forced out, the seventh race is a maiden race.
So yeah, that was a little gnarly.
It started in the fifth race, and I just basically set the board in the fifth race. And then the seventh race, it was a really wide-open maiden race with a bunch of firsters, and that, you know, that was a giant guessing game. So I guessed right in that race, and I sort of guessed right in the fifth, but I was gone by the Demoiselle didn't end.
I got two more questions for you. I've kept you longer than I said. If you need to get to a panel, let me know. We can pick this up another time. But I need to ask one about your background, and I've got to ask about your most memorable day, of course. We'll start with a question about your background. I've heard you talk about growing up in the D.C. area and reading Andy Byers' columns as one of the things that inspired you to want to take up this great game. But I'd love to hear a little bit more about what got you into racing in the first place.
Well, the first part of it is that, so I grew up in D.C. and I was a big sports fan, but my ability to consume sports was constrained by the fact that we did not have cable TV in D.C. until district cable vision in 1989, until I was a junior in high school, which is unbelievable.
Savagery.
In retrospect.
Savagery.
Cable was like a rural thing. And so we would go over to people's houses who would have ESPN, and I would watch Australian rules football or motorcycle racing. If it was sports, I'd be watching it. So my access to sports was, you know, the 3 minutes on the local stations. And I still remember my three.
George Michael?
George Michael, but actually we didn't NBC broadcast. We lived right next to NBC and it broadcast right over our house. So we didn't get NBC. So I never watched an AFC football game. So mine were Frank Herzog and Glenn Brenner. I did not get to watch George Michael in the sports machine because I didn't get that station. So, you know, the whole NBC Thursday night lineup that existed back then, wasn't able to watch because I would live too near NBC. So, I would see the 3 minutes of Glenn Brenner and Frank Herzog. I would read the sports page of the Washington Post, and the Post had a huge racing section. They had all the charts. They had a full page devoted to it. Clem Florio made picks. Andy Byer wrote like a column a couple times a week, and I started reading Byer. And Byer was I loved reading articles about sports. I read Sports Illustrated. I loved sports writing. And Byer, you know, obviously a fantastic horse player, but a fantastic writer.
Yes.
And so as a result of seeing those charts, I became more interested. I'd obviously watched the Derby. I do remember going to a Derby party growing up and thought the race itself was very exciting. And so, you know, sort of from the sports page and interest in the Derby, I bought Andy Byer's books, started reading those. And in about seventh or eighth grade, you know, where a lot of kids get into baseball because of the statistics, I got into horse racing because it was all about statistics. I would make the mile walk to people's drugstore, and I would, the form was then $2. And so I'd find 8 quarters and grab the form and look at races at Penn National, come up with all sorts of, simplistic, algorithms or whatever you call them to try to make bets. I remember, driving out to Pimlico and making a $20 bet on a horse to show. Ridiculous thing to do, but betting $20 on a horse named Quail Rid Flop. My brother and I went out there, so that was my first trip to the racetrack. That's my connection. It's basically, everyone in my family thought it was bizarre, a phase that I would grow out of. And so I went to graduate school. I was doing research on my dissertations on like banking regulation, really boring stuff. I got my job at Rhodes and I was evaluated 50% on research, like I've already mentioned. Now I realized that there's a lot of freedom in terms of the research I can do. And so, I realized there was this huge literature on betting markets. At the time, the University of Louisville had a conference as part of their equine business program, where they would, you know, a lot of people who do betting market stuff and who do research related to horse racing, there were over 100 articles published. So I collected all those articles. I had a programming friend of mine start to harvest TVG data. And so we put together sort of price pool data in 2002. So it was kind of cool to come in at night and scrape up all the pricing data. And that became the foundation for a handful of research papers I wrote. I got a college grant to do a betting arbitrage experiment, which is a lot of fun. And so it became the basis of my research, and sort of the rest is history. At some point I got, I was in a position where I could claim a horse. And so got into horse ownership that way, met Clay, started claiming more horses together. And then, you know, now put together horse partnerships, where 10 Strike Racing has about 50 horses in training and involved in a lot of different circuits. We've won races at 24 different tracks since inception, and we have 82 wins this year, over $3 million in earnings.
Phenomenal. I'll ask you one more about your family. Your brother, Jeff, very talented musician. There's a famous story about your father giving Jeff his blessing to pursue a life as a musician, as long as he got a real job by a certain point. I believe this was featured on MTV back in the day. Did your dad ever give you a similar talk when it came to this horse racing stuff? It was okay as long as it didn't get in the way of having a real job.
I think it sort of dropped off the radar by then. So it was, I was really into it 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. You know, and then, you know, I'm in high school and college happens. And at that point, like, so this is the sort of backing up for a second. So my dad was the U.S. Senator from Texas, Phil Gramm. And then he ran for president of all things in 1996, which is still kind of surreal to me. I don't think I totally grasped that. And that was a very different time. And I was, you know, it was a very different time without social media, and I didn't really read, you know, I'd read the sports page, but not the front page. And so sort of my awareness of, you know, it being a big damn deal, he's running for president, I really wasn't aware of that. And I went to the college I went to is fairly apolitical, and my friends weren't really interested in politics. I feel like that, you know, I had about as normal a college experience as would have been, you know, what may not have been possible today. And so, you know, at that point, I was just a college grad going to grad school. And so he was, you know, he wasn't really worried about my brother either. But, I don't think the racing thing had sort of taken off. I didn't have any sort of money to be betting seriously. I was in the state of Texas, so it had just legalized betting, but you had to go to the racetrack. It was before ADWs. It was really, you know, my renewed interest in racing. Sort of my second phase of racing happened with the introduction of ADWs, because in college and in graduate school, I was in part too busy and in part not in a position where I could go really to there. I would go to Sam Houston every once in a while as a graduate student at A&M, but not in a position where I could bet seriously until, you know, I got a UBet account when I moved to Memphis. So I thought that was, you know, when I took the job in Memphis, I could go to Southland Greyhound and bet the simulcast, and then I got a UBet account with the rise of simulcasting, and I still think about what a glorious era it is to live in, where we can bet, you know, there's racing 22 hours a day, right? We can wake up and bet European racing. We can bet horses during the day, and at night we could bet Australia. So it's Hong Kong. So it's a wonderful era to live in. I think the thing with my brother is more along the lines of that my dad was asked about, my brother was in a little indie band that would play shows, and he did a little bit of touring, but to say they went on tour would mean they packed into a car and would play something like 40 shows in 39 days. I think I went with them once, and I was sick and out of commission so fast because they would sleep on floors and just and stay in just some awful places. And so, I think that he was asked about it and had the sort of funny off the cuff answer that, that got my brother a little bit of, they had a little MTV clip, which I thought was kind of cool. Was they would play one of his songs on MTV, and this article was written. You know, I can't tell whether the writer was writing it more tongue-in-cheek. My brother did do the band thing for a while and did temp work while he did it and had a lot of fun and had experiences I don't think he'd trade for anything.
Fantastic. If you'd been more into racing, maybe while that spot was on MTV, we could have had you over on ESPN, but wasn't meant to be.
I know. It would have been interesting if Graham's son, degenerate gambler. I think that would have played totally different in the 1990s. And I think that one would have played totally different.
Oh, it's so funny.
So in many ways, I'm kind of, going. Look, the other thing about, again, the being a politician's kid is very different without the sort of social media. My parents were never very sort of go. I didn't know any other politicians' kids. So they didn't, my parents weren't very sort of in, there was sort of no social scene. I grew up in DC, right? So there was no, I didn't go to school with any other politicians' kids. And my parents didn't go out a lot to events. And I do remember like the sort of realization that the things were changing was, I guess there was the story on Jenna Bush underage drinking at a Chewy's in Austin or something like that. And I remember thinking that, boy, things are sort of changing, and now I think that anyone involved in politics, just they're sort of hit left and right.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. A different world, and probably not a better one in that respect.
And look, there are many other ways. It's a different world. I do think that, many other ways. My dad, left the Senate in 2004 and, went on to do different things. So
we're going to let you get out of here eventually, I promise. But I do want to ask you, you've had some time to let your subconscious work on this question. Your most memorable day betting horses.
I think one of my most favorite days involved a horse that you owned a piece of, and that was Long on Value. Now, it's not so much Long on Value. Long on Value was a horse that we bought at auction in the November sale for $100,000. We actually weren't – we thought he would be out of our price range, and somehow he fell into our price range. So we owned 40% of him, and you and Jonathan took a piece. And your piece is actually – I know Jonathan would say that you would own a small strand of the tail hair. And I think your all piece is about equivalent to my piece because so many people wanted in on the horse. And so the night that Long on Value made his stakes debut for us in the Mighty Bow was a day of a Churchill Downs pick six fourth out. And so Clay and I, Clay, who's again the other main founding partner of 10 Strike Racing, we play a lot of our multi-race wagers together. We've put together a pick six that we often do when there's some of these carryovers. And so we put together a pick six to make a chase after this. And we had other people who were at the track. Clay was at Churchill and I was watching from home, and it was one of those evening cards. And so we had a bunch of people who hopped aboard the player pick six, which is, fun, but also somewhat nerve wracking. Cause it's, whenever someone asks you for your picks and thinks you're a good handicapper, you invariably, when you fall on your face, but we had, put together a $3,200 ticket, and things just broke really well for us. Got a couple long shots in, got into the last leg where was an allowance race where a horse named Mississippi was coming back off the Derby trail in a two other den. He'd run really well for Cassie in the Florida Derby, and he was one of the two favorites. And then Mr. Freeze was a 9-1 shot. We had those two horses live for the last leg, and both horses were in the back of the pack. And so early on, we thought there was no chance, but Mr. Freeze came from back. I ran into some trouble, but got up to win, really ran like he knew we had a bunch of money on him. And we hit for $90,000, and a bunch of our friends were involved. Clay was the toast of Churchill Downs that night because of all of our partners were there. And were celebrating us. And then two races later, Long on Value wins the Mighty Bow. And so days where you can have a nice big score just south of six figures and then win a stakes race. So as an owner and as a bettor, that was one of my high points.
That's fantastic. That's magic stuff for sure. to be able to put it all together. How do you compare big gambling wins with big wins as an owner? I've owned a few horses, and you know, I certainly feel like there's some comparability to it. But when you do it as much as you do, how do you compare the two?
Oh, I think of them as the same. I think of my horse ownership, especially when you're a claiming owner. And maybe Tommy Matthews can speak to this as well, is that when you claim a horse, it tends to be a bet. It's just a longer-term version of a bet,
yep.
Right? Instead of I'm finding a horse that I don't think, you know, where I find value in it, in betting the horse, because it's finally getting under the right condition. When I claim a horse, I'm looking for a horse that has not been running in the right types of races or is on the wrong circuit, and try to move them into a position that gives them a better shot to win. And so, you know, I consider a lot of what I do on the claiming end is just a natural extension of betting. And so I think of Lucky Move as one of my nice scores. That she's a filly that looking at Lucky out of a Quiet American mare that screams long dirt, New York bred. And so I sort of, as soon as I saw the breeding, I kept her in my stable mail for over a year. And finally, she came up at a reasonable price in Kentucky. And she's a New York bred with New York bred conditions. And I thought that the Saratoga Mound Ace, which plays like a mile and a quarter, which plays really long, I thought she would be exceptional at that distance. So I claimed her, and she'd always been stuck running sort of one turn miles, and they'd thrown her on the turf, right? Thinking if she routes, they'd put her on the turf. And so, she ran once at Churchill, ran third going a mile, and then we brought her up to Saratoga. It just happened to be a day that I was there. I tend not to go to my own races unless I'm already there, right? Because it's just, you know, you lose more often than not. But I just happened to be there. My family was there. It was when we were doing our trip up to Saratoga, our sort of 2 weeks of summer up there. Bentley Combs is the trainer. We bought her up there, ships in, runs a huge race, wins. And so, you know, it's in the winner's circle at Saratoga. There's not much better than that to capture a New York bred heir than then, you know, get a piece of a huge purse, with a mare that we claimed for, $30,000.
That's like so, hitting the pick six
and so and she should, she ran back in the stakes at Saratoga, and she should run in the stakes, a New York bred stake at a mile and eighth at Aqueduct on December 29th.
Nice.
So we're actually, you know, this is something you still ride out. So those owners, you know, for claiming, it can be a lot like betting. And then, you know, there's nothing else like experiencing a homebred runner that, you know, Clay and I with Critical Value, watching her win the Maze of the Mist. You know, when you have a homebred, you've been with that horse, you know, even longer than it's been alive. You've been playing the breeding. You've been through all the ups and downs. And so the little success I've had breeding, there's nothing more rewarding. A Dot Matrix is a horse I've had. He's been a lot of fun. A real war horse that goes out and always gives a game effort. It's one of my favorite horses. About the only horse if he walks by, I know who he is. I'm so bad. Horses, I could never be a visual handicapper. I really rely on people like Maggie Wolfendale for that kind of stuff. She does a great job on all the broadcasts. But, you know, all horses to me, they're all beautiful. They all look the same. And so Dot Matrix is one who looks different to me, right? They always call him Clyde because he looks like a Clydesdale to me. But with homebred, it's a little bit different. It's a different sort of feeling of accomplishment
for sure.
For having been through it, having had a horse for so long.
We had the funny conversation on Twitter the other day with my friend Tim Day. I can't remember, but it was something asking you about, like, being surprised that you didn't bet on your own horse. And I said I could even just relate from my own experience in ownership. You know, when you're owning them, most of the time I felt like I had enough on, you know, there was already so much riding on it. Do you have a tendency to bet your own horses?
I do. If I think there's value there, I mean, there's no doubt I'll bet my own horses. But with Critical Value, she was 4-1. I would have bet her at 10-1, but she didn't offer enough value. And look, for a filly who's already a stakes winner, with a filly, you get to keep your residual value as a broodmare prospect. And if she were to win the Grade 2 Demoiselle, I mean, suddenly she's on the Oaks Trail. Suddenly she's worth six figures as a broodmare. suddenly the offers start coming in. I mean, that at that point, I mean, just there's no amount of money I could bet on her that could that could measure up to her increased value as a result of you know, a strong showing in the Demoiselle.
All right, you've got conferences to get to. I've got a show to cut and publish. We're entering Monster Pod territory in terms of length, but everything you said, Marshall, there's so much good stuff for horse players, prospective owners, etc. in here. Thank you so much for your time and contributions and ongoing support of this podcast. We appreciate you very much and hope you have a great time out there.
Thanks, Pete. I appreciate you having me on.
And that's going to do it for this edition of the show. We will thank our partners, including 10 Strike Racing, Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, and Stats Race Lens. Most of all, I want to thank all of you, the listeners, who make these shows so much fun to do. This show has been a production of In the Money Media. In the Money Media's business manager is Drew Coatney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I think he's talking to Mattress Mack right about now, trying to sell him an ad. I'm Peter Thomas for Natal. May you win all your photos. Hi, everybody. Peter Thomas Fornatale here. Do you regularly enjoy this show or any of the shows on the In the Money Network? Well, do us a favor. Take less than 4 minutes to fill out our new audience survey. It's going to help us find our partners for 2020 and also to shape some of our content. I'll give you a couple of different ways to find the survey. Probably the easiest is to just go to my Twitter homepage. It's pinned to my page right there, twitter.com/loomsboldly, and it'll be the tweet that's right at the top. If that sounds too complicated and you still want to help out, I'll give you a long URL to go directly to the survey, https://peterfornatale.typeform.com/to/COCN1Y. Yeah, like I said, probably easiest just to go to my Twitter. We really appreciate your help.